Welcome to the online ministry of Pacific Beach United Methodist Church, located in beautiful San Diego, California. Pacific Beach UMC is a member of the Reconciling Ministries Network and welcomes persons of all ages and backgrounds for worship, study, and service opportunities. More information can be found on our website at pbumc.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
Now, in typical Pauline fashion, Paul begins this passage by telling his readers what they're obligated to avoid. Right? He begins by saying what you're obligated to avoid rather than what we are obligated to do. He argues that we are obligated to avoid living on the basis of selfishness. Now, we all think we know what it means to be selfish. But I also know that as human beings, we tend to figure out ways where we can kind of perhaps bend the rules a little bit so that maybe I can get what I want and you can get what you want. And it doesn't look like it's selfishness, but I still kind of get everything that I think I want. So for me, I believe the best definition of what it means to be selfish is found in Jesus' greatest commandment. That's what I turn to when I try to think about what it means to be unselfish, I guess I should say. Jesus' commandment says to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And it is this last part, loving our neighbor as ourselves, this part is at the heart of unselfish behavior. So if you're not treating someone how you would like to be treated if you were them, then your actions toward that person can be considered selfish, right? So you have to treat them how you would like to be treated if you were in their particular position, right? Not how you think they ought to be treated, but how you believe if you were them in their shoes, in their station in life, how would you want to be treated? You are to treat them in that way. This, my friends, is hard. This is not an easy thing to do. So in this way, I would argue that selfishness is rooted in a love of self that transcends the love for self that transcends your love for human beings and transcends your love for God's other creatures. It's this focus on the primacy of the self and getting what you want more so than loving your neighbor as yourself. So on one hand, Paul tells us that we are obligated to avoid being selfish, right? And in verse 17, he goes on to say that we as children of God, as fellow heirs with Christ, we are also obligated to suffer with Christ so that we can be glorified with Christ. Suffer with Christ is a very challenging phrase. So what does Paul exactly mean by this? And I want to spend some time unpacking that, if you will. Now, I'm going to pull a Paul, and I'm going to tell you here what I think Paul is saying suffering isn't, basically. Well, how he's using it and what it doesn't mean. Paul here, when he talks about suffering, he is not talking about redemptive suffering, a type of theology that argues that in our suffering, we grow closer to God. This kind of theology has been used to justify oppressive Christian practices from slavery and segregation to spousal and child abuse. God does not will us to be in a state of suffering. This is stuff we talked about in our sermon series on biblical half-truths, right? God does not will us to be in a state of suffering. Rather, I submit that what Paul is talking about here when he uses the phrase suffer with Christ is how we as Christians are obligated to respond to the suffering of the world as Jesus modeled in his earthly ministry. Paul is reminding us what Jesus says in Matthew 25 in a parable that describes the moment when all human beings will be judged for their actions. Now, in this parable, Jesus separates humanity into two groups. He says the sheep and the goats, but it's this group on his right that we're going to focus on right now. He separates them into two groups, and to the group on his right, he says, "Come and inherit my kingdom, because when I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. When I was sick, you took care of me. When I was in prison, you visited me." And the righteous, those on his right hand, they will reply, Lord, when did we do these things? And God replies, saying that whatever you have done for the least of these, you have also done for me. Whatever you have done for the least of these, you have also done for me. So you see, church, I believe a faithful response to the obligation we have to suffer with Christ is in our obligation to see the suffering of the world as Christ's suffering and to do something about it. We have an obligation to see the suffering of the world as Christ's suffering and then do something about it. In this way, I believe that it is actually the task of seeing suffering that is one of the most difficult challenges of our time. Seeing suffering is one of the most difficult challenges of the modern era. Our ability to turn away and shield our eyes from the suffering of others is really highlighted in Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale. As Pastor Bob explained last week, a handmaid is basically a concubine, or a breeder, if you will, for men of high rank in this land of Gideon, this Christian land, if you will, or I guess supposedly Christian land, that's built on kind of particular Old Testament Hebrew Bible kind of principles. Now, a handmaid, they're basically a concubine because the leaders, the men of high rank in Gideon and the women are experiencing high rates of infertility in their community. And so in order for them to survive, they need people to actually bear them children. Now, the handmaids in this text are not treated as full human beings. They are not treated as beings created in the image of God. They are not even given names. Rather, their names are dictated by their owners. So, for instance, in one of the primary characters in Atwood's book, one of the primary characters' name is Ofred because she is the handmaid of Fred. Ofred. I say it's her name. Ofred, like all other handmaids, had to go through a training and education program that was supposed to make her understand her role in this particular society, that it was supposed to make her submissive, a training program that was to help her understand that she was to not have really any desires of her own. She was not supposed to have any kind of moral agency. So that when she is given to Fred, she recognizes that she has no freedom of her own, that she is only allowed to go to the market. She's only allowed to go to church, and she's only allowed to have sex with Fred once a month to try to conceive a child. Other than that, they're supposed to be kind of sequestered and isolated. Now, as I read this text, I couldn't help but wonder how the wives and the leaders of this community, how they could actually... I wondered if they actually saw these handmaids, how the wives actually saw these women. I can't help but wonder how the citizens of Gideon could allow this to happen. How could they not see the injustice? How could they not see the suffering of these handmaids living in isolation? Friends, I submit to you that sometimes, like those people in Gideon, we don't see injustice or suffering either because, unfortunately, we have trained ourselves to view suffering from our own comfortable perspective rather than viewing suffering from the perspective of those who suffer. We have trained ourselves to avoid making eye contact with the homeless person so they don't ask us for money. We've trained ourselves to avoid watching certain news shows because all they talk about is the suffering taking place in places like Syria, where millions of people have lost their homes and thousands have lost their lives. We have positioned ourselves so that everything we experience on a daily basis conforms to the worldview we want to believe to be true, that ultimately everything is okay. You see, church, as Christians, we are not supposed to shield ourselves from the realities of this world. We see in the life of Jesus that actually we are supposed to engage in the realities of this world. As Paul notes, the Spirit of God resides in each and every one of us, and it is this Spirit that ought to compel us to suffer with Christ. It is this Spirit that compels us to see the suffering of the world as Christ's suffering. And when we truly see that suffering, when we stop judging those who are suffering for how they got into their current situation and simply place ourselves in the position of the sufferer, if we simply place ourselves in the position of those who are oppressed and ask ourselves, how must it feel to be them? How must it feel to not have a place to call your own? How must it feel to be hungry when we just put ourselves in their particular position? When we do this, we humanize them. When we do this, we see them as our neighbor, and we develop a sense of empathic compassion that can help us love them as we love ourselves. When we see them as a child of God, we can have a glimpse, a taste of their suffering. And when we see them in this way, we can't help but cry out to God in what sounds like a groaning prayer. We can't help but to groan for the children who will go to bed hungry tonight because they live in a community with little access to food. We can't help but groan for the queer young adult who feels trapped and unable to be their true self for fear of being abandoned by their family. We can't help but groan for those who fear losing their health coverage because the current politics of our country says their health does not matter. We can't help but groan for those in rural communities who lost their agricultural and industrial jobs and have no idea how they are going to provide for their families. We can't help but groan for the hungry, the thirsty, the sick, the immigrant, and the prisoner. We can't help but groan and cry out to God because we see the suffering of the world as Christ's suffering, and we have made the choice to suffer with Christ. And yet, in the midst of our groaning, Paul tells us in verse 18 that the seeds of hope are being planted. That this groaning process plants these seeds, build up this reservoir of hope. Paul reminds us that the present suffering is nothing compared to the coming glory that is to be revealed to us. He tells us that it is, in fact, hope that saves us. Hope, like Paul is describing, is not grounded in the naive presumption that everything will somehow work itself out without any effort on our part. Rather, because we have seen and felt the suffering of our neighbor and suffered with Christ, because we have cried out to God in a groaning prayer, Christian hope sustains us through our groaning. Christian hope sustains us throughout this kind of lamentation process. And it is the spirit of hope that dwells in us and holds us while we suffer with Christ. It is the spirit of hope that compels us to then work to end such suffering, to work toward the realization of the world that God desires, the realization of a world saved in hope, a hope that we find in Jesus' defeat of death, a hope that we find in the resurrection of Christ, a hope that we embody when we live with the end in mind, meaning that when we live into God's vision of the beloved community, this community where people of all races and all classes and all gender and gender identities come together in love and in reconciliation with all creation, when we live into this vision of the beloved community and we pull people towards this vision, when we do this, we know that we may groan in the pulling of people towards us in this vision. We still recognize and are deeply aware that we are saved in hope. And it's this hope that will sustain us throughout this groaning process. Amen?
Amen?
Amen. I'd like to invite you into a time of prayerful meditation. If any part of the service has moved you, whether it be my message or music or anything else, I'd like to invite you a few moments of reflection, and then we'll come together in a communal prayer.
An opportunity to be connected together as a community of faith. And so I invite you to join me in this community time. Holy and gracious Creator, we are glad that you have drawn us together in this place, in this time. We come from different places, different walks of life, different experiences. Indeed, we are a symbol of the beauty of your creation. And yet we are united in your love. We are connected in compassion and care. As we turn to you, not only with those things that challenge us, that cause grief, but also those things that bring joy, that we celebrate, we know that you join in all of these things with us. Holy God, we lift up all these things to you and any of the prayers of our community that are left unsaid as we join together in the prayer taught to us by your Son, our Christ, as we say together, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.